KQED.
From KQED Public Radio, this is the California Report. In for Scott Schaefer, I'm Catherine Barron. Coming up, bad science or bad politics. The Bush administration rejects a study on bilingual education. And on our series, Tales of California Housing, Central Valley farmers are cashing out.
You can't blame a farmer for selling his land for housing because he can make so much money an acre. He can basically be set for life. And even his children are set for life.
Also, more restaurants are saying salud with the Korean liquor soju.
If you put it with Coca-Cola and a lime in it, it tastes like rum. And if you put it with tonic, it tastes like vodka. It's excellent. I love it.
Those stories end. Will that be paper or plastic? It's the California Report. After 3 years and nearly $2 million, the U.S. Department of Education has decided not to publish a report that could benefit millions of immigrant schoolchildren in California. Education Department officials say the research by the National Literacy Panel on the best ways to learn to read English failed to meet standards for quality. Skeptics question whether the decision is politically motivated, a charge that has dogged the Bush administration in other scientific studies. James Crawford is director of the National Association for Bilingual Education.
We wonder whether it's the results that the administration doesn't like, the fact that it shows that bilingual education is superior to all English approaches for teaching children to read in English.
English immersion classes are the standard under California's Proposition 227 and similar laws in Arizona and Massachusetts. Crawford says while he has no evidence the federal government is suppressing the study, he suspects the results were uncomfortable for the Bush administration.
We don't see them as open enemies of bilingual education, but on the other hand, some of their strong supporters are English-only advocates. And our suspicion is that they don't want to offend such people by releasing a report that shows that bilingual education is doing a very good job.
What's more, Crawford finds it hard to believe that a panel of the nation's top scholars in the field would write a poor quality report. But that is precisely the situation, says Grover Whitehurst, director of the Institute of Education Sciences at the U.S. Department of Education.
The original draft came in roughly a year ago, and we had it peer-reviewed at that point, and the reviews were negative, so we knew we had a problem.
The panel reworked the original 800-page report, whittling it to 600 pages. But Whitehurst says the second draft didn't fare much better.
One reviewer said, "I found the report difficult to read." Another reviewer said, "The report is accessible only to the most diligent of readers."
Even some panel members agree with those assessments. Michael Camille, an education professor at Stanford University, said diplomatically that the quality was inconsistent.
I read the reviews and found that they made some sense, that they did seem to have substantial grounds for saying that this was not up to the quality that the department wanted to publish.
Fellow panelist Claude Goldenberg heads the Center for Language Minority Education and Research at Cal State Long Beach. He says he understands why many people are skeptical. The Bush administration has a bad track record when it comes to manipulating scientific findings to fit political ideology.
They have set themselves up for this completely. I mean, it couldn't have happened to a more deserving administration. It just turns out it's not true in this case. That's the irony of this whole thing.
In February 2004, more than 60 scientists, many of them Nobel laureates, wrote an open letter accusing the Bush White House of censoring and distorting research on such issues as global warming, endangered species, and condom use. Last year, the New York Times had to file a Freedom of Information request to get the Department of Education to release a study showing problems with charter schools. That history even has Diane August, the principal researcher on the National Literacy Panel, questioning the department's motives. She doesn't think censorship is an issue, but says it could be.
I don't know what's going on, really. I mean, I don't know what's going on. So I'm not saying it is an issue or it's not an issue. I'm just saying I don't know. Maybe it is, but I just don't know for a fact.
August, a senior research scientist at the Center for Applied Linguistics, says even if politics wasn't at play, she has other beefs with the department. She agrees that early on the quality wasn't up to snuff, but says that's what the review process is all about, getting feedback. Plus, she adds, reviews were all over the map, with as many glowing comments as critical ones.
So you'd have like a reviewer say, this chapter is so clear, it's just exactly what I was looking for. And you'd have another reviewer say, there's way too much detail in this chapter. You know, and besides, I don't think you should be reviewing these studies.
The panel's chairman, education professor Timothy Shanahan of the University of Illinois at Chicago, faults the Institute of Education Sciences for not providing this kind of guidance early on when it would have been possible to change course.
They'd participated in the decision-making and the discussions that at the end that they weren't happy with some of those decisions that we'd made really surprised me.
The panelists did get a consolation prize. The Institute gave them the copyright to the report. Shanahan says they already have several scholarly publishers interested in it. And he admits that in a perverse way, not having the government seal of approval may make the final report more acceptable in the scientific community. Throughout California, bars and restaurants that don't have a full liquor license are nonetheless serving up cocktails like Cosmopolitans, Bloody Marys, and Mojitos. That's because of a unique provision in the state law regarding a Korean distilled spirit called soju. L.A. Bureau Chief Alex Cohen has the story.
6 months ago, Hope Taylor was about to open a bar in a hip section of L.A. known as Echo Park. Taylor realized she couldn't afford a license to serve hard liquor, and that made her panic.
They were like, oh my God, we only have beer and wine. We can't have just what everybody else has. So I was like, what about that soju stuff?
Soju is a clear spirit that's been distilled in Korea since the 13th century. It can be made out of rice, barley, even sweet potatoes. As she stands behind the bar at her now thriving business, Hope Taylor pours some soju over ice, adds fresh cherry juice, and shakes the concoction up. The result? A delicious drink Taylor calls the Little Joy. There are nearly two dozen soju-based cocktails on the menu here. Taylor says soju's subtle taste makes it a very versatile drink base.
If you put it with Coca-Cola and a lime in it, it tastes like rum. And if you put it with tonic, it tastes like vodka. It's excellent. I love it.
Why is this Korean liquor allowed in places where other spirits aren't?
Soju actually has probably what I would consider to be a unique exception in the law.
Dennis Clear is with California's Department of Alcoholic Beverage Control. He says in 1998, an Association of Korean Restaurant Owners successfully lobbied the legislature to allow soju to be served in restaurants and bars, even those without a full liquor license, so that Koreans could enjoy what's known as their homeland's national drink.
What they presented was, I think, a very obviously effective and a very logical argument that within their community, there was a very specific need for their clientele to be able, in typically a smaller venue, to partake of this traditional national drink.
But, Clear adds, there are some restrictions. All soju served can be no more than 24% alcohol, and it has to be imported. Most soju in California comes from Korea, but there's nothing in the law that says soju can only be served at Korean restaurants.
It opened the door for obviously non-Asian restaurants to do that as well. It wasn't, kind of culture specific.
That's Steve Lavigne, president of Golden State Soju, a company that distributes soju in cocktail mixers. He says on average, a wholesale bottle of soju costs about $10, a bit less than the average bottle of vodka. Golden State Soju now distributes to more than 450 non-Asian restaurants and bars throughout California.
What's happened now is those non-Asian restaurants have begun utilizing soju to make cocktails or even to serve it straight to their clientele.
Lavigne says soju is an attractive option for business owners looking to avoid the high costs of liquor licenses. A beer and wine license in California costs $300. A full liquor license, $12,000. And such licenses can often be difficult to get. Another state law allows no more than one per every 2,000 people per county. Lavigne says his business is doing very well, but he doubts that soju will hurt sales of other spirits. Tim Clark isn't so sure. Clark heads the San Francisco-based company Infinite Spirits, which makes a brand of vodka called Shakers. Clark says the soju exemption doesn't really allow for a level playing field.
I don't think it's necessarily fair that one of our lower proof vodkas would not be able to be served in that same establishment where soju is able to do so.
Clark says he takes comfort in the fact that the soju exemption is limited. The only states that allow it in establishments without a full liquor license are California and New York. For the California Report, I'm Alex Cohen in Los Angeles.
California's Central Valley is now the fastest-growing region of the state. Over the next 25 years, it will take more than 1 million new housing units to accommodate the population growth in the state's agricultural heartland. In part two of our series, Tales of California Housing, reporters Sasha Coca in Merced County and Peter John Schuler in San Jose examine how housing threatens to transform the Central Valley in much the same way Silicon Valley's orchards were paved over years ago.
You remind me of him.
Yeah.
The eastern light slants through the doors and windows of C.J. Olson Cherries, illuminating the market with pools of sunlight. The shelves, made from old cannery boxes, are lined with baskets of some of the plumpest, darkest, most tempting fresh cherries you might ever see. Proprietor Deborah Olson chats up a local customer, just as her grandmother Rosie did. This roadside fruit stand has been in the same spot for nearly 70 years.
We just finished harvesting a huge crop. We had a great crop of Bing cherries this year. It's the first time in many, many years, so we were quite busy.
Well, have a great trip. Thank you, Pat.
Acres of fruit trees once surrounded the stand. Now a 53,000-square-foot shopping center dominates the corner, and Olson makes ends meet by leasing space to Borders, Starbucks, and P.F. Chang's. Because this isn't someplace in the Central Valley, but in Silicon Valley, once known as the Valley of Heart's Delight.
I just remember orchards everywhere. That's what I remember. And then I remember coming back from college in like 75, and the name had changed from Santa Clara Valley to Silicon Valley. I had no idea what that meant. You know, we were sorting cherries on the cherry belt, and at that time, Steve Jobs would come over and help sort cherries just to say hi, and his dad, and so I was trying to understand what Silicon Valley is.
1984 annual shareholders meeting. I'd like to open the meeting with a part of an old poem, about a 20-year-old poem by Dylan. That's Bob Dylan.
When the 20-year-old Steve Jobs was sorting cherries back in 1975, nobody realized he would soon revolutionize the computer industry and the region as co-founder of Apple Computer.
For the loser now will be later to win, for the times they are a-changing.
The explosion of the computer industry brought an influx of jobs, people, housing, business, and enormous wealth. The transformation dealt the final blow to the remaining agriculture in Silicon Valley. The Olsons now farm just 13 acres of prime orchard land purchased by the city of Sunnyvale and designated as a heritage park.
About 90 miles east of the Olsons' cherry stand, another farmer watches a tractor plow under rows of cotton to make way for development. Fred Oliveira has farmed on the edge of the Merced County town of Los Baños for nearly 30 years. But now he's sold 140 acres to a developer whose luxury homes already edged up against his farm. Oliveira and his daughter Patty say it was an easy decision.
We thought, you know, if homes came around us, it would make it that much harder for us to farm. It's hard enough to farm, but much more when you have a lot of people around you.
You
can't spray, you can't do nothing. So
it makes your life harder. It makes it more expensive.
For many farmers, selling land to a developer makes sense, especially when they can get upwards of $100,000 an acre.
You can't blame a farmer for selling his land for housing because he can make so much money an acre. He can basically be set for life, and even his children are set for life.
Mayor Michael Amabile is driving down the main boulevard in Los Baños. The population here has nearly doubled since 1990.
Right out here is our new water tank. We went from 250,000 gallon tank to 5 million. And we're already designing the next one.
In Merced County, in the decade after 1992, housing gobbled up more than 15,000 acres of agricultural land, a spread about half the size of San Francisco. Loss of land makes it harder for farmers to survive, but so does the loss of the vast infrastructure that supports an agricultural economy.
Take the Olsons back in Sunnyvale. Deborah says making a go of farming has become virtually impossible. Think about it. More houses, more strip malls, more office parks, it changes everything. From the temperature and the kinds of backyard plants to the local population of bees. Bees that pollinate fruit trees.
Having most of the land covered by asphalt has changed the microclimate in this area, so you're not getting a lot of fruit like you used to. You know, you used to have a lot of pollinator cherry trees all over the place, and nobody has a cherry tree in the backyard anymore like the old days.
And now in Silicon Valley, it's hard to find all the businesses that support farmers. Tractor repair shops, feed stores, farm labor contractors.
Irrigation installers, packing houses, trucks to transport crops. These are the kinds of businesses that are endangered in places like Los Baños as well, even though the Central Valley is more than 17 times the size of the old Valley of Heart's Delight. Carol Whiteside is director of the nonprofit Great Valley Center, a think tank focused on growth and change.
We're certainly not in danger of paving every acre of agricultural land in the Central Valley. Not for a very long time, if at all. But I think what we have to worry about is the tipping point. Because at some point, the growers and the food processors lose confidence in their own future. They stop investing in irrigation systems. They stop planting permanent crops. You get a psychological conversion that may be more important than the conversion of acre by acre.
Perhaps few would argue that Silicon Valley was a bad thing. It became a huge economic engine for the state and internationally. But experts agree that the willy-nilly style of growth that created Silicon Valley isn't good for California. Terry Christensen is professor of political science at San Jose State University.
What's done is done, and now we try to compensate for it, but of course everything isn't done, or we wouldn't be talking about what's happening in the Central Valley. And San Jose and Santa Clara Valley can't just pass their housing responsibilities on to that side.
But that's precisely what's happening. In Los Baños, nearly half the town's 30,000 residents commute to San Jose or the Bay Area. If those residents are ever to have hope that their house will become a home, connected to a community, and not just a docking station for a commuter life, they need local jobs. Towns in the Central Valley are scrambling to replace the economic engine of agriculture with new businesses. Mayor Amabile says he's tried to convince South Bay companies to open a branch in Los Baños. Several years ago, for example, he approached IBM.
I was telling one of the vice presidents that there are 250 of their employees live in Los Baños. And we had done a survey, and this is what we had discovered in our survey. And he really couldn't believe that. It turned out that his secretary lived in Los Baños. He did not even know that. When we walked down the hallways of IBM, I had all these people coming up to me and saying hello. They were Los Baños residents.
IBM didn't agree to open a satellite office in Los Baños. There are major differences between Silicon Valley and the Central Valley, differences that may dissuade high-tech companies from relocating. Mayor Amabile.
This valley has always had the stigma of a bunch of farm people that aren't very educated to live here.
In the Central Valley, UC Merced opened this fall with a focus on engineering and sciences. But regional experts say it could be a decade before the university is established enough to anchor new businesses.
By contrast, the Santa Clara Valley's major universities, led by Stanford, spun off new industries and a ready, educated workforce. The Naval Air Station at Moffett Field attracted defense jobs.
In the Central Valley, poverty is so high that if the area were a state, it would rank 48th in per capita income. It's also the most ethnically diverse rural area in the United States. That means planning meetings to address growth sometimes have to be conducted in a dozen languages.
The Santa Clara Valley's population was homogeneous when it urbanized in the 1950s and 60s. It was wealthy, and short commutes allowed residents to engage in local politics and other civic activities.
But the biggest difference is the Central Valley is the breadbasket of the state. Indeed, the nation. And that, says Carol Whiteside, means that as the area adds 5 million more people in the next 25 years, there are big questions for Californians to ask.
I think the question of food security is something that we ought to talk about, and that's not anthrax and airborne diseases, but whether or not this country wants to have enough farmland to feed itself. or whether we are willing to become dependent on imported food.
Yeah, that taste.
Nowadays, most of the fruit at C.J. Olson Cherries in Sunnyvale comes from somewhere else. Washington State, Montana, Canada, Chile, and New Zealand. The Olsons' primary business, and one of the last legacies of the Valley of Heart's Delight, has changed from a 1930s farm stand to an international reseller of premium fruit, complete with a website and overnight delivery. For the California Report, I'm Peter John Schuler in Silicon Valley.
And I'm Sasha Coca in the Central Valley.
Next week, we'll have the third part of our series, Tales of California Housing, with a look at the lessons Central Valley towns can take from the sprawling development boom that created Silicon Valley. That's the California Report for this week, a production of KQED Public Radio. Our director is Susie Rocho. The technical producer is Seal Muller, with additional engineering by Paul Ancor and Danny Bringer. Our editor is Pat Flynn. The producer is Stacey Bond. The senior producer this week is Kat Snow. I'm Catherine Barron. Thanks for listening. Have a good weekend. This is the California Report.
Funds for the California Report are provided by the California Healthcare Foundation, committed to improving California's healthcare delivery and financing systems, on the web at chcf.org. The James Irvine Foundation, expanding opportunity for the people of California. TIAA CREF, serving those who serve others by offering financial services for the greater good. TIAA-CREF.org. Charitable Auto Resources, a full-service vehicle donation program management firm, which helps nonprofit organizations increase their revenue. Online at charitableautoresources.com. And the Stewart Foundation, for coverage of important issues in public education.